Call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order, January 26, 2005. Junkie and I are here. We can start. We're going to make a few changes here in the agenda to try and accommodate some schedules here. First off, if we could have Mr. Al Christofferson come down. As soon as we do have a quorum, we will break into the meeting and we will do a few of the things that we need to do here. And then... I almost said members. Member.
Thank you.
We will then go from President Christofferson to Paul Sobosinski from Land Stewardship Project, and he has some guests here, and then to Mary Jo Forbord, and then Bob Arnn from the NFL. Then we'll go back up top and work our way down. So, again, this is more for informational than anything to talk to our commodity groups, various associations, so the committee can find out who they are, and the committee will soon learn. It's still early, Mr. President, in the session that we start on time no matter what. So with that, welcome the committee, sir, if you could please provide your testimony.
Okay, thank you very much, and I am Al Christofferson, and I'm a farmer from Kanduay County, but I'm also president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Certainly, thank you, Chairman Davidson, and the committee for taking the time to hear what we see as some of our priority issues, and these are issues which we recently approved in our delegate session back in the end of November, and this is where we're going to provide our focus for the year. In terms of promoting animal agriculture, it's certainly not acceptable to allow the public to be led down the road of making a false choice between agriculture and the environment. For too long, we have let the public and decision makers develop the belief system that the mere existence of livestock leads to environmental degradation. And we don't feel that's true at all. Farm Bureau and farmers must work closely with the public and all units of government to show how livestock drives Minnesota's economic engine while protecting and many times improving environmental quality. For farmers to capture additional value from the market, more focus needs to be placed on feeding Minnesota-grown commodities to Minnesota livestock. Without the retention, the upgrade and expansion of livestock within Minnesota, we place in jeopardy our vibrant ethanol and biodiesel production systems. Homegrown livestock is essential for the feeding of dried distillers, grain, and soy meal, the byproducts of renewable energy production, and the energy component in corn and soybeans will not cash flow the grains alone. We need to have a market for those byproducts. We certainly support the efforts of the Governor's Livestock Task Force, especially initiatives such as the implementation of an investment tax credit program for farmers to modernize and update their livestock facilities and management practices. And we need to stimulate investment in animal agriculture, and the tax credit program will assist that. We as an organization will continue to work with local, state, and federal governments to address the difficulties in siting livestock operations, with particular emphasis on working with local government on these challenges. At the end of the day, we need a livestock siting process in Minnesota that is transparent, predictable, not a moving target, and allows farmers to invest in their livestock operations. We look forward to the results of the Livestock Siting Task Force appointed by Governor Plenty, and to working with your committee, Chairman Davids, as we seek positive solutions to these challenges.
Mr. President, if I could stop you right there for just a second. Excuse me, please. We do now have a quorum. We'll officially call a meeting of the Agricultural and Rural Development Committee to order. Representative Hamilton moves the minutes of Tuesday, January 25th, 2005. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, and for the members that just arrived here, we're going to be going a little bit out of order here. We've got President Christofferson, who I so rudely interrupted halfway through his testimony, but we want to get on the record and be in being official here. And then we'll go down to Paul Sobosinski from Land Stewardship Project, and then to Mary Jo Forbord, Bob Arnn, and then back up to Mr. Clevin, Graff, and down the list there. So just so you kind of know where we're going here, there's some method to my madness here. Okay, Mr. President, please continue.
Going on to the next priority issue, which is no net loss of private property. Based on the most current available data, approximately 25% of Minnesota's land mass is owned by governmental units. And the following is a breakdown of land ownership in Minnesota. Total land mass is 53.8 million acres. Private land and Indian reservation land amounts to 41.4 million acres. Land owned by the state of Minnesota is 5.9 million acres. State forests is 3.2 million acres. Wildlife management areas are 1.1 million acres. That owned by the federal government is 3.4 million acres, and owned by county government is 2.9 million acres. Now, those are a lot of figures, but nevertheless, it does indicate we are concerned about state government and their ownership activities. We're also concerned about state government agency plans to acquire additional land from private land ownership. By acquiring land from private land owners, the state takes this land off the tax base, and this in turn takes money out of our communities by depreciating the tax base. This has long-term economic benefits in rural areas. Minnesota Department of Natural Resources plan to steadily increase the number of acres that they plan to acquire in the foreseeable future, and their struggle to adequately manage the land they currently have does not make practical sense, especially during times of tight budget deficits. Farm Bureau voting delegates overwhelmingly adopted a position of no net loss of private land in Minnesota. We oppose further acquisition of land by the state of Minnesota without the state selling a corresponding amount of public land back into private ownership. We are also on the record insisting that all levels of government pay for their share of the costs associated with maintenance of publicly owned land. Next issue, water quality. One of the most talked about issues early in this session is the impaired waters program of the Clean Water Legacy proposal. We anticipate the Clean Water Legacy legislation to be introduced in the near future. Farm Bureau supports an impaired waters program in Minnesota that utilizes scientific methods of determining all sources of impairments, including naturally occurring impairments, and focuses on cleaning up the water. We oppose farmers being held responsible for impairments which farming activities did not cause. We continue to support an equitable fee structure with the majority of revenues collected being used for restoration of impaired waters. Agriculture needs to have an active role in the development and the implementation of TMDL projects, including the allocation of funds. Our organization has been an active participant in the development of the Clean Water Legacy legislation and is supportive of the concepts contained in the legislation. We will continue to work closely with members of this committee and other legislators to ensure agriculture is treated fairly as this legislation moves through the process. Farm Bureau supports passage of funding for the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, the CREP program, in the bonding bill. This is a program that will provide farmers another tool to address water quality issues. Renewable fuels. As I stated earlier, a thriving livestock sector is essential for Minnesota to continue to be a leader in renewable fuel production in the United States. Farm Bureau policy continues to support increasing the amount of ethanol and gasoline sold in Minnesota. The implementation of the statewide biodiesel requirement and efforts to increase the use of these fuels. I might add that I'm also on the American Farm Bureau Board of Directors, and at our board meetings I spare no attempt to chide some of my friends from around the U.S., asking them when they are going to get on board. It is fun to be a leader in the industry of renewable fuels, and I think Minnesota ought to feel proud of that, and I think we need to enhance that even more so. Atrazine. We fully expect legislation to be introduced that will ban or restrict the use of atrazine in Minnesota. Farm Bureau supports the regulation of crop protection products on a federal level. We will strongly oppose any state initiatives to place restrictions on or ban the use of atrazine or any crop protection product on a state basis. Forestry. It is important for this committee to remember the important contribution forestry makes to Minnesota's total agricultural economy, especially in northern Minnesota. We will be working with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources on how their timber sales are conducted to ensure independent loggers have access to raw forest products. Transportation. The modernization of the Mississippi River lock and dam system continues to be a high priority for our organization. While this is a national issue, we certainly encourage members of this committee to work with our federally elected officials for enactment of the current 2004 Army Corps of Engineers plan to modernize the Mississippi and Illinois waterway system. Of more immediate concern on a state level, our voting delegates emphasized the need to invest in Minnesota's highway infrastructure. Highway investment is necessary to ensure that we can deliver our commodities to market and ships and ship imports back to our farms. In particular, there is an increasing need to upgrade our county road system to a 10-ton system when practical. Now, our organization supports an increase in the state gas tax, with that increase used for road and bridge improvements. We will work with legislators to ensure rural Minnesota receives its fair share of the highway investment funds. Animal identification. To protect our nation's livestock industry from disease outbreaks, Farm Bureau supports a national animal ID system that is cost-effective, confidential, and confidentiality is perhaps the biggest concern that most agricultural or livestock producers have. Protects farmers from financial liability and be locally administered by the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Methamphetamine. And I never thought 5 years ago that we would be talking about methamphetamine as an agricultural issue, but it really is an agricultural issue, even though it is at least not yet not agriculture. While not specifically an agricultural issue, our voting delegates acknowledge the growing severity of methamphetamine usage and production in Minnesota and the negative impacts of this growth on rural communities. We support stiffer penalties for the production and usage of meth. We are opposed to innocent landowners being held financially responsible for the cleanup costs of meth labs and dump sites. If suppliers and or distributors of anhydrous ammonia are mandated to put agents into their products to help deter meth production, the expense should not be passed on to farmers. I got to add a footnote here in that these are issues which concern us as farmers. And I am not suggesting here that we are not concerned about the health aspects of methamphetamine and what that is going to do to our health care system down the road. That's another issue. But in terms of dealing with ag issues, I'm confining my comments to that part of it. That is a huge issue, is that I don't have to tell you that. Then University of Minnesota Extension Service.
Excuse me, Mr. President, Representative Mull.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, just a quick question on anhydrous ammonia. Does the Farm Bureau have a position on somehow curtailing access to that? I know Representative Hamilton and I have talked about how difficult it is actually to put that under lock and key. Has your organization thought about that or have a position on it?
President Christopherson.
Chairman, Representative, I think we have talked about it a number of times, and I think we are scratching our heads just like the rest of the industry is. We would welcome a way. I guess one of the things then that we have to be concerned about is the cost of whatever, and perhaps that's our biggest concern. But we would certainly be open to anything in which we could, in some way, shape, or form, curtail the utilization, not the least of which is the theft of. And in many cases, it is not the amount that they take out for what they're going to use it for. It's for what happens to the rest of the tank that most of the time gets left open. And so it's a bigger issue than just that. But it is also, and I guess the other side of that is, most of those people, at least to the point at which they decided to try and make meth, they weren't born yesterday, and so most locks are able to be manhandled somehow. But nevertheless, that is an issue, and we are not opposed to any form of trying to figure out how we can get a handle on that, because everyone loses in that process.
Representative Magnus.
Mr. Chairman, just on that note, I read something recently where the anhydrous manufacturers, I understand this year, are going to put an additive in anhydrous that will prohibit the use of that for human things. But like Mr. Christopherson says, they're clever at finding ways around everything. But that's my understanding. They're putting an additive in it this year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Magnus. Okay, please continue. President Christopherson.
Okay, I just have one item left, and that's the University of Minnesota Extension Service. Our voting delegates remain concerned about the changes to the University of Minnesota Extension Service, which have resulted in a reduction in county support for extension. Farm Bureau continues to support local county extension agriculture programs, especially 4-H programs, and adopted policy favoring increased funding for county positions. And 4-H and FFA, while we're not talking about FFA here, those are two of the programs which we in agriculture really value in terms of the learning tools that we need to promote, yes, rural living, but also the furtherance of our industry of agriculture. And so they are extremely important, and as I have listened to some of our members and other members at hearings with dealing with 4-H and the funding of 4-H and those types of things, you have people that have dedicated their entire volunteer lives to dealing with 4-H, and they know what it means. And so that is a real concern of ours, and we need to get our hands around that one also. Finally, thank you, Chairman Davids, and committee members for the opportunity to share with you the positions that our voting delegates have identified as important in the 2005 legislative session.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And members, if you want to keep this, we do have names and addresses and so forth right there. So, hi, Gerken.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question and a request for information. In regards to the CREP program, and I understand the Farm Bureau has gone ahead and pretty much gave it its blessing, but I want to make sure that you follow along a little bit more closely than you did last time with the Minnesota River CREP program, where it came up in my district, and it's quite far away from the Minnesota River, and put entire farms in Polk County in that program, which was not the intent of it. We have to be real careful about that. But the question I have, and I just have one question, is 25% of the property is in is owned by the government. What percentage of the remaining 75% are in government programs like CREP, RIM, CRP, et cetera?
President Christofferson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't know that figure, and you have identified the other leg. At least it is still in private ownership, those that are in the programs. But you are right, but nevertheless, in terms of land that is being used for conservation purposes and wildlife habitat and so on, there's a lot of acres.
Person Heikirchen. Okay. And thank you, President Christofferson, for your testimony. Next, we're going out of order here a little bit. Paul Sobosinski of Land Stewardship Project, and he has some constituents of mine with him, Bonnie Haugen and Thor Haugen from Mabel Canton area, Mabel Canton School District, the city of Canton, or the rural area of Canton, home of the Mabel Canton Fighting Cougars. They're awesome. They're awesome. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sobosinski, and Bonnie and Thor. We're glad you're here today. H-A-U-P-E. Just go ahead and grab a chair there, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and appreciate you welcoming us and giving us the opportunity, as well as our LSP board members, Bonnie Haugen, and also her son, Thor. The Land Stewardship Project is a farm and rural organization that works to promote sustainable agriculture. We're primarily a rural membership organization made up of family farms, rural residents, and others. Our membership is diverse. We have people like Dave and Florence Menar in New Prague, who have a 165-cow dairy operation and are certified organic and have cows on pastures. And they process and sell milk produced on their seeded suburb farm. We have members like Rodney Stahlbeck from Sacred Heart, Minnesota, who's conventional, grows corn and beans, and has a farrow-to-finish hog operation. What all our members have in common is a strong belief in independent family-owned farms. We believe in family farms. I want to give a quick overview of some of our work. We have a farm beginnings program. You're getting a handout on that, plus a farmer loan program that helps train new farmers in low-capital, environmentally sound farming practices. It links participants with experienced farmers who serve as mentors. We also have a zero-interest loan program working to help get people started. Part of this process is working with people with, for example, developing of a business plan. Another project that we're very engaged in is a project called Promoting Local Foods Through Pride of the Prairie. And one of our emphases there is connecting the farmer with consumers, the food with a face on it. We look at that if you look at developing and building local markets, those are markets that the global economy cannot take away. It's differentiating yourself in the marketplace. LLC also works on federal farm policy. This work includes our work on supporting a packer ban, COOL, country of origin labeling. We oppose vertical integration in the meat industry, and we support ending the mandatory pork checkoff. Our other work
you support what on the checkoff?
Ending the mandatory pork checkoff. Oh. We also have been very active in terms of the federal farm bill and working for the conservation security program, with the whole idea of rewarding farmers on working farmlands for stewardship. LFP works at the state level, and since 1998, we have played an important role in securing state dollars for research and funding profitable, environmentally sound ways to raise livestock. Some of the state policy work that we have played important roles in included working for funding for the University of Minnesota to do research on sustainable swine systems, securing funding for research facilities at the University of Minnesota at Morris. We've worked and been involved in the issue last year working to get additional loans for on-farm processing. We work with both Representative Lyle Poonen and Representative Erdahl, who helped move that part forward. We appreciate that. We're an organization that believes strongly in protecting township and community rights, local control. LSP believes that a strong local community requires strong local control. In fact, 83% of Minnesotans in a recent poll conditioned by the Minnesota Environmental Partnership indicated support for local control. In terms of legislative priorities, let me say that our priority is to move forward, first of all, the recommendations of the Citizens Task Force on Livestock Farmers in Rural Communities. This was recreated by LSP, Minnesota Farmers Union, NFO, and Sustainable Farming Association. My understanding is that a future date that there perhaps will be a hearing in this committee on that report, and we look forward to that opportunity of sharing our joint vision of creating a bright future for livestock farmers in Minnesota. With that said, some of our key priorities for this session are passing a bill that encourages the next generation of dairy farmers in Minnesota by creating a $100 payment incentive cap at $10,000 per year for up to five years. We're excited today that bill is, as a matter of fact, we're supposed to have a hearing today at 3 o'clock in the Senate. We support CREP in the bonding bill. We would like to see some of the CREP land be available for grazing as long as there's a state-approved plan. Grazing plan enhances and protects water quality and wildlife habitat and environment. We issued a recent paper published in Bioscience that shows how livestock farms can benefit watersheds. I'd like to hand that out at this point, something perhaps, you know, for future study. Well, I got two handouts that way. One is just a short press statement on it that we had, and then the report itself. And this report involved a number of key players in looking at how Minnesota water quality could benefit from more grass and hay cover on the landscape. And then in terms of other priorities, we would like to see moved up this year in terms of legislature is to provide $200,000 per year in funding to the Minnesota Alternative Swine Program and expand it to include dairy and other livestock systems. So that'd be $400,000 for the biennium. This program has been very successful in working with alternative swine in the state. For example, my own personal experience, I have transformed my operation because of what's happened in the hog industry into a straw-based system, and my hogs for the last 2 years have been marketed with Nyman Ranch. Since 1998, when hogs hit the depression lows of about $8, well, worse than depression lows, about $8 a hundredweight, Nyman Ranch has grown from 30 producers to 400 producers that covers Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, and just starting in North Carolina. So we see that same kind of opportunity. While the market seems to be closing on one hand on family farms in terms of hog production, we see the same opportunity existing now and ought to be approached in terms of the dairy. We also support funding for MESA, the Information Exchange Program, and then again, we support that no matter what we look at in terms of farm policy and livestock development across the landscape, that finally that the local decisions, the local citizens should have the ability to make the decision about the type of development they want in their communities. And with that, I'd like to introduce Bonnie Hogan, who is an LSP board member and her son, and she's going to share just a few thoughts and their experiences in the dairy industry.
Thank you, and welcome to the Agriculture Committee. Ms. Hogan, if you could please proceed.
Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Chair Davids and other representatives. I've recently just about done reading this book by U.S. Senator Dr. Paul Simon on water and the shortage of water that's likely to be coming worldwide. Really very interesting. I think we are going to have a water problem, both in quality and in quantity. And that's one of the reasons why I'm very proud of the way that I farm. My farm has a lot of hills, and at once upon a time was called by the zoning administrator the worst farm in Fillmore County. That was before I bought it, when I was asking him about questions. I have a lot of hills on that farm, 230 acres. Our family bought the place in 1993. We have a lot of springs on that farm. Natural springs come out about two-thirds of the way up the hill. We have live water on that farm. I think it's very important to take care of the water. It's been proven many different times that grass forages will help filtrate clean water, recharge our water sources a lot easier than some of the other crops. I am very biased. I am a grazing and dairy farmer. Not organic. I manage intensively graze my animals, which means they get fresh patch of grass every 12 hours. We have an extensive lane system. I like it. You're certainly welcome to come take a look at it sometime. We'll give you a ride in the four-wheeler if you dare drive with a woman driver. 1993.
Ms. Hogan, I think you should invite the chairman for a tour.
All right. You are so invited.
Okay.
Please call for an appointment. While I am the part of our household that's on the farm most of the time, my husband is the university extension agent in Crawford County, has been a big part of producing this CD-ROM, talking about low-cost parlays, and I would like to leave this with you so that anybody could take a look at this. As we talk about changing the dairy industry in Minnesota, there may be a place for the bigger expansions, but I think there's really a better and wider place to improve the smaller dairy farms and as well as boost up any of those smaller ones if they want to expand to the 100 or 200 level of dairy cows. Not many of our neighbors will complain about 100 to 200 cows in the neighborhood on a dairy farm. They do get upset about hearing about 1,000 dairy cows in any one farm. I think that's right. I think that they're two totally different farms. They have to be handled very differently, in my opinion. Therefore, I think that local control is really very important, an important issue to keep local control. When we think about the dollar per hundredweight legislation that they proposed, an example for our farm, in 1993, when Vance and I bought the farm, 230 acres, with another couple in a partnership to start, which failed after 2.5 years. But for starters, we bought 230 acres. We bought 105 cattle that first year. We had to buy all our feed. We had budgeted for milk to be at $13. We had budgeted for it to be at $11. The forecast was for $13, so we thought we were safe. We're cheap Norwegians. We thought we were being conservative, you know. Milk went to 10. Now, Vance and I were talking about this briefly last night. Initially, he said, $10,000 a year, that's not really worth anything, you know. Is it worth the effort? And I said, well, but remember how really tough it was for us those first couple of years. He said, oh, yeah. I mean, I think that $10,000 boost to a good beginning dairy farmer could be worthwhile. We don't want to buy them their farms, but a help, something like that, they've already had the work, you know they've already put out the milk. $10,000 can go a long way on an OG factor. Oh, gee, I didn't know this was going to happen. Oh, gee, I didn't know that was going to happen. I think that would be, could be a very worthwhile thing. And wrap up, I'd just like to add an answer to a question earlier about the anhydrous ammonia. Just like that, if we had more grazing farms, there would be less ammonia being used in the first place. An example. Everybody has bad days. And I think Bert can tell you that in the worst of my days, and I'm all ready to say, this is too much work, this is too hard, I'm going to check it out. And it's usually been one of my three kids, Inga, Olaf, or Thor, yes, we're Norwegian, that says, no, Ma, calm down. We know you like it here. And I say, yeah, but in the first few years, we really did our work way too hard. We're beginning to get things in place where it's not quite so bad now. And I said, but aren't you working too hard? No, we're okay. We like it. We're going to stay. So he said, yep, we're going to stay. So I think that we must be doing something right on our type of farm for my kids to say that, yes, they are willing to stay there and we're not super anxious to leave. So with that, yes, of course, you are welcome to our farm anytime after my representative has been to my place. Thank you very much for your time. And, Thor, do you have anything you want to say quick? Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll go to Mary Jo Forbord now, Executive Director. Okay, welcome to the committee. Mary Jo, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
I'm Mary Jo Forbord. I'm the Executive Director of the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota. I'm pleased to be here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm far from a regular at the legislature. In fact, this is the first time I've ever provided testimony, so I appreciate you taking your time to hear more about what's happening across the state in agriculture and considering the diversity that is ours to enjoy. The Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota was formed in 1988, and it is a statewide nonprofit educational organization of farmers practicing environmentally, economically viable, and socially responsible farming systems. Sustainable farms yield a diversity of food, fiber, and renewable energy. Wisdom, experience, and values guide sustainable farmers toward farming methods that support local and regional food systems, diversified and decentralized production, community health and prosperity, and a high quality of life for generations to come. As a farmer, I am pleased to give my time to work for this organization. My husband and I farm in western Minnesota, about 150 miles due west of where I am right now, between Starbuck and Benson, the beautiful hill country, the rolling glacial moraine of Polk County, in Representative Bud Heigerken's district, as a matter of fact. Sustainable Farming Association works to develop and enhance sustainable farming systems through networking, innovation, demonstration, and education. Being passed around or will be passed around is our quarterly newsletter. And in the newsletter in the center section, you will find one of the major projects that is very near and dear to sustainable farmers, and that is who will farm the land, the next generation of sustainable farmers. We invite you to the campus of the University of Minnesota Morris, which is, as you know, also in western Minnesota, where a lot of innovation in options in agriculture are going on, alternative dairy production. My husband and I were in dairying until 2002. Unfortunately, when we looked at options for the next generation, we were only given two, expand or expand. I would like to see that dairy farmers are given more options then expand or expand. And there are plenty of them out there, and there are plenty of success stories on the land within sustainable agriculture. We really do not need to look far. We are a very diverse state. We have three biomes. Sustainable agriculture is site-specific agriculture. It is much more a management of an ecosystem than it is an industry. One thing that has been extremely positive for sustainable farming within the last 5 years is the growing interest on the part of consumers to know where their food comes from, who is growing their food, and how that food is being grown. Sustainable farmers now can enjoy market and value-added premiums for foods that are produced right here in Minnesota and in our own regional areas. One of the traditional hallmarks of Sustainable Farming Association has been to implement more sustainable farming systems and practices through innovation and demonstration of profitable and environmentally sound farming methods that benefit family farms and communities. As I mentioned, the Sustainable Farming Association's 14th annual meeting will be centering on mentoring and encouraging farmers and the next generation of farmers. There are farmers like my husband and I who are transitioning in place. We are transitioning from dairy into a rotationally grazed operation. We are direct marketing beef. We are certified organic, or are going in that direction. We aren't certified yet, but we are transitioning toward organic, and we are enjoying a high demand and a high premium for our product. There may be a misperception that you may have heard about sustainable farming that is sort of back to the 50s. However, when I walked in the room, some of you noticed a logo of the Minnesota grown product that I'm wearing, and I'm wondering how many of you can identify that logo that I'm wearing. Not bad, great name recognition. This logo is for Shaker's Vodka, which is made in Benson, Minnesota, and it's made from wheat and rye that we grow on our farm. This is the kind of trademarking that gives farmers an opportunity. It seems that farming does have more opportunities, and only one of the opportunities is to be a commodity producer, which is driven by volume and low cost. However, as a farm family and looking at the next generation, we cannot be assured that U.S. farms would be the lowest cost supplier. And we found the commodity system the most difficult market to envision our future within. There are also cooperatives, farmers banding together, and there is also a growing market for direct marketing to consumers, and that is definitely as a bright spot. With other objectives that we have as an organization, we are in the process of redoing a website that will become a trading post for sustainable farmers, being low input producers. We are not the industry darlings. We are not the input suppliers' best friends. We look for profitability first and foremost for the farmer, because that provides the firmest base for our food system. Also, in the area of government and university, we are gaining more attention. The university, we do have science behind what we do, although we haven't had enough studies on farming systems. Minnesota Institute of Sustainable Agriculture is one of the gateways that we have into the university. The Sustainable Farming Association did participate with Land Stewardship Project and Minnesota Farmers Union and the National Farmers Organization to write a report that I hope you will hear quite a bit about and more of this legislative session, and it's called the Citizens Task Force Report on Livestock Farmers and Rural Communities. In that report, you will find a number of items that are very important to us, including increasing farmer participation in the developing and expanding community-based food systems. In Minnesota, we are innovators in this area. There is the Southeast Food Network in the southeast portion of the state, Whole Farm Co-op in the central part of the state, Superior Grown in the northeast, and Pride of the Prairie in my own community, where farmers are venturing forward with high-quality products and retaining more value in the marketplace, and therefore creating a much brighter, viable economic picture for our rural communities. We're also working toward informing and educating consumers about healthy food and farming practices that yield a diverse array of sustainably produced food, fiber, and energy. We are looking at the very positive attributes that have been mentioned for grazing, of animals, and also the nutrition profiles. I worked 20 years in the area of nutrition, and it's very interesting to now see research that shows that products raised differently, for instance on grass versus corn, have a different nutritional profile, and many people are talking about the omega-3 fatty acid content of nutrients in grass-based products. We in Minnesota need to connect the dots between our food and our farming and our health and our environment, and especially that most essential of all nutrients, water. And it is time that we all work together in ways that will benefit all of Minnesotans. We have the resources to do so. We have the diversity at hand. We need more communication. Who will farm the land and how the land will be farmed are questions that I often ask as I look around my own rural community, as most farmers in my community are well above the age of 55. Young people have exited rural areas, and many factors indicate the time is right for all Minnesotans to consider and weigh in on what we want from a food system and how we will achieve it. In my opinion, our current system has resulted from some lack of vision and very little inclusiveness, coupled with plenty of conflicting governmental policies. We in Minnesota can do better. We have some dissatisfaction growing with this approach, and I think that we are in for a change based on the growing market demand for low-mileage, sourced and processed identified foods, and strengthening those linkages between food, farming, rural communities, environment, health, and social justice. We are certainly not there yet. The road is certainly rough, as the market share enjoyed by the current system is threatened by an emerging one. But I'm glad that I've lived long enough to see it and maybe be a little bit of a catalyst for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mary Jo, thank you for coming down. And it was
a
pleasure. Yeah, it was a pleasure being invited out to your pasture walk last summer and had a good time out there. But again, the reason why I asked the Farm Bureau that particular question, because I know we have we've got some good ideas about grazing and using some of those properties for grazing. We need to look at that. But thank you for the presentation.
Thank you, and may I say you're all invited to Graze Fest 2005, and Bud will show you the way to the farm.
Grass Fest? Great. Okay, Mr. Bob Arndt, National Farmers Union. Thank you, Mary Jo, for your testimony. Bob Arndt, National Farmers Union. Welcome to the Ag Committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon. My name is Bob Arndt. I'm the state president of the Minnesota National Farmers Organization. That's a different organization than the Farmers Union. And I thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to testify on behalf of our members. I'd first of all like to give you some background about the National Farmers Organization, commonly known as the NFO. It's a nationwide organization of farmers and ranchers who are actively producing food and fiber. It was organized based on the Capital Olmsted Act of 1922, and the purpose of the organization is to give farmers and ranchers a way to act together in collective bargaining to position themselves so that they can negotiate for prices and beneficial marketing terms with local or nationwide buyers of their production, namely livestock, grain, and dairy commodities. We all heard the statement, perhaps, that you can't do anything about the price in the markets. Don't believe it. It works like this. Producer members list their production that they will deliver through the NFO structure for the coming year. This production listed on paper is then forwarded to the NFO National Commodity Department's headquarters in Ames, Iowa. And each commodity department then combines that listed amount of production and offers it to large volume and packages it together and offers it to large volume nationwide buyers or state or area-wide buyers and processors. Negotiations take place, terms are agreed upon, and delivery is made by the producers who have listed that production and willing to deliver it to those processors. The buyers who agreed to the most beneficial terms generally get the product. This process is ongoing, and delivery takes place as negotiated. NFA is a not-for-profit organization. All proceeds negotiated goes to the member producers who delivered. Each state within the organization is structured for the purpose of promoting collective bargaining for the production agriculture and for working with the political arena to keep a strong owner-operator free enterprise system in rural America. The national structure of the organization works with the economic arena, negotiating in the marketplace. That's basically what the National Farmers Organization is all about. Our concern is the growing power of concentrated capital by corporate entities who seek ways to invest their capital into production agriculture. Now, I want to point out that agriculture is not just agriculture. We have it has three entities. It has production agriculture, it has agribusiness, and agri-industry. Agribusiness must speak for itself and should not be speaking for production agriculture. Agri-industry should not speak for production agriculture, because in most cases, agri-industry wants cheap raw material, while production agriculture demands a cost of production plus a profit to pay off debt and hold on to the assets and maintain a strong world economy. In effect, production agriculture and agri-industry are on opposite sides of the spectrum. While agribusiness provides the inputs that production agriculture uses, along with a lot of advice and new information, which may or may not be beneficial to production agriculture. So therefore, we are saying we believe that production agriculture must serve out and speak for itself in all areas of the economy. I point this out so that there is no misunderstanding that we are not against corporate capital, but those corporate entities and structures should remain in the fields for which they were intended. Processors as processors, grain merchants as grain merchandisers, retailers as retailers. But when they seek to invest their capital into production agriculture, their capital, coming from many sources within the corporation, overwhelms the investment capital that family owner-operators have with which to compete. Corporate capital invested captures the assets they invest in and adds those assets to the long list of holdings with no chance for citizens to reclaim those assets. On the other hand, when family owner-operators borrow money to invest in their business for whatever purpose, whether it's new or expanding, they borrow against their personal assets and have the ability to reclaim those assets as debt is repaid. The capital for repayment of debt must come from the marketplace. With that said, we ask that this committee, the legislature, act for the long term. We don't want the assets of rural America to be added to the long list of holdings of national and multinational companies with no chance to reclaim those assets. With existing trade agreements and pending trade agreements with China and the Ukraine testing the water of capitalism, we will see in the future an increase of multinational capital eager to own a piece of our great American production agriculture. Our food production industry is too important to throw it open to whoever has the biggest package of money. If we weaken our antitrust, anti-corporate legislation, even a crack, we can expect a flood of investment capital. And as concentrated capital infiltrates, its power will dominate. Production agriculture is so important, involving so many areas of our economy, that the fuel of capital must not skip a beat. And we understand that. We need that capital to come from the marketplace so debt can be paid and assets retained. We must strengthen our anti-corporation laws and expand our Minnesota Collective Bargaining Act for producers in agriculure. Provide money to our Department of Agriculture to hold seminars and educate producers about the process of collective bargaining in the marketplace as part of risk management education. Enact legislation to provide that any producer building new or expanding their livestock operations must provide a source of capital if the cost exceeds $250,000 at the time a permit is applied for. This is to close loopholes from the infiltration of corporate capital. We would rather see farmers partnering with their neighbors and to partner with the corporate interests that invest money and be absorbed. We would like to see legislation that would provide capital to beginning farmers, and we encourage this committee and legislation to move forward with the recommendations brought forth by the Citizens Task Force on Livestock Farmers and Rural Communities. And with that is my presentation. And I thank you for your attention and for your time.
Thank you, President Arndt. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Arndt, how many, in NFL, how many operator owners are members?
President Arndt?
Mr. Chairman, it's a number that I don't know. And one of the reasons we don't even talk about how many members we have is because a member in numbers of farmers is not important. It's the amount of volume those farmers can put together so that we can offer the packages, the production to the processors we negotiate with. If we had 1,000 farmers with 1 million bushels of grain, or if we had one farmer with 1 million bushels of grain, it would make no difference. We still got 1 million bushels to negotiate with. So numbers are something we don't talk about. It's an ace that we don't divulge to the people that we negotiate with. Therefore, I don't have that answer for you, and I'm sorry.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Arndt, just a follow-up. The volume of bushels, I know it varies from year to year, but is it generally increasing then?
The volume of bushels moving through the...
Volume of product.
Of product moving through the National Farmers Organization. The volume of product is increasing year by year. In dairy, we have not increased substantially in livestock like we would like, but we have increased more than what the livestock numbers have increased nationwide outside of the organization. In grain, we are increasing steadily year by year, but our dairy is our strongest suit right now.
Representative Erdahl, thank you. Thank you, President Arndt, for that presentation. I look forward to working with you. Next, we go to Mr. Bruce Clevin, representing today the Minnesota Wheat and Barley Growers Association, the Sugar Beet Growers and Potato Growers and Poultry. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the groups just stated by the chairman and also on your agenda. And I would tell you, Mr. Chairman, that our preference, of course, is to have a president of the organization or someone from our board come. And we had a number of conflicts with national meetings on all of those groups or just simply logistical scheduling. And so they left it up to me today to deliver their message for you. So today I'll be talking for six groups, and Mr. Glenn Graff from the Cattlemen's Association will provide the beef industry testimony. I'd probably like to begin with wheat and barley, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right. And probably as a backup, as an opening comment, I probably feel a little bit compelled to tell you as members that the Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, the soybeans, pork, all these groups here would probably want to let you know that they're also sustainable and environmentally friendly groups. I don't think we want to be left with the impression that the groups that preceded me here are more that way. They have a different way of doing it, but I don't think we should be left with the impression that other groups aren't sustainable or environmentally friendly. All that's on the minds of most of our members. But anyway, let me start with wheat and barley specifically. There are two organizations in our state. One's the Wheat Growers Association, one is the Barley Growers. They're both housed out of Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. And their issues are similar, so I can cover them together. The acreage is concentrated in the northwest part of the state, clearly. It's just simply the belt for wheat. It's a cooler climate than down in the south area. You'd have to probably move towards winter wheat if you got very far south. And so the northwest area of the state is where the concentration of hard red spring wheat is. There was 1.7 million acres of wheat planted last year, and that is down from, say, 15 years ago when it was probably 2.5. And the main reason for that is wheat scab that broke out in 1993. I think Representative Pennis probably had some personal experience with that at the time. That year, the growers burned a lot of the wheat. They just simply lit the fields on fire. And the wheat scab is a fungus that develops in the head of the wheat if there's real humid conditions and if the spores are present, if there's the right amount of wind. And so that happened in 1993. And for several years in the 90s, wheat scab robbed the growers in the valley. And so the scab issue remains to be solved. There are some resistant varieties that have been developed over the last 10 years or so. Alson is one. Pioneer 2375 is one. They have some resistant qualities to scab, there are some protein and stock strength issues with those as well, and so the research needs to continue. And that actually leads me into the first priority for these two groups, and that would be research funding at the University of Minnesota. That's very, very important to the wheat and barley growers. It's a theme I think you're hearing from all the groups, is the University of Minnesota funding. Related to that would be the funding for AURI, which I understand from the governor's budget was not cut. It was funded at the level from last year, at least in the governor's proposal, so we're happy to see that as well. Third, relating to funding for these groups, would be the checkoff issue. Mr. Sobosinski mentioned the pork checkoff. Specifically, there are many, many other checkoffs, and for the wheat and barley growers, it's not the promotion part so much, it's the research part. And they are partnering with the U on a lot of their checkoff dollars, in particular for scab and other things. And so their view is to see that the checkoff continues because it's important for the research component. And we've seen that with the scab problem. Also, there may be some questions by members about GMO wheat. That's been a big discussion in North Dakota in particular, not so much here, but in North Dakota definitely, about the use of GMO wheat. And our board and membership seems to be fairly open to that idea. If there's a GMO solution to, say, lodging on stock strength, protein, concentrate, and particular scab, if there can be a result from there, the growers would be very interested in GMO wheat if it's scab-free. Of course, they recognize the consumer market in that you have to get over that consumer hump because you are dealing with a food product versus, say, the soybeans, which can be for meal or oil or whatever. And so you have that food sensitivity. That remains for wheat and barley because barley is used for malt and beer. And so you're dealing with a food-grade product, but they are open to that. Other issues quickly, Mr. Chairman, on wheat and barley would be pesticide regulation. Our growers don't really like environmental groups telling them how to farm. They use federally licensed products that they pay a lot of money for. There are label restrictions on there. The label is the law. You have to follow the law. If the label on the can says you can't spray if it's over 10 miles an hour wind speed, if you spray when it's 15 to 20 and you have drift, that's a violation of the label. You can be prosecuted by the Department of Ag. And so the growers generally know that. And so they're very concerned about movements to restrict their use of their crop protection products. Truck laws is also an issue for the growers during harvest time, overweights and permits and so forth. Wetlands and drainage. The wheat and barley growers have been very involved with wetlands and drainage over the years and will continue to do so. And finally, they have been trying to get an ethanol plant up in the Crookston area to use wheat and barley as a primary fuel source. Obviously corn, and you heard this yesterday, corn has been a primary component here in Minnesota, but wheat and barley can be used as well. And so there is an effort to get one up by Crookston, probably not with the payment program, but just simply to participate in the ethanol market. And so there's some efforts for that. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's my comments on wheat and barley. I don't know if you're taking questions on that. I would stand for them, of course, before I move to the next one.
Why don't you proceed, Mr. Clark?
Sure. All right, Mr. Chairman, next probably the sugar beet industry quickly. Minnesota is the number one sugar beet producing state in the country, and that's probably a little known fact. North Dakota is number two, and we have nearly 500,000 planted acres here in Minnesota. North Dakota is second at 258. The economic impact is about $3 billion from that industry. And again, like wheat and barley, the concentration of beet acres is up in the northwest. There is a belt around Ripson Junkie, Ripson Conan, in the west central part. There's a plant there. 32% of the beet sugar comes from Minnesota in the union. There's also cane, of course. Cane makes up a bunch of the sweetener used. But chemically, you'll find that beet sugar and cane sugar are absolutely identical. The chemical compound is C12H22O11, and so you can't tell the difference between them. It's just simply the way it's grown. Beets are a root crop that grow underground. Cane is a tall stalk. But when they're refined, they're the identical product. Minnesota has the distinction of being the, not anymore, but at one time they were the only state that had 100% farmer-owned beet factories. You don't find that in the other commodities. But if you grow, you can't just grow an acre of beets. You have to have a place to take them. And so in order to do that, you've got to have shares in the factories. There are three different factories in Minnesota. American Crystal Sugar Company is headquartered out of Moorhead. They have a factory in Moorhead, East Grand Forks, and Crookston, Minnesota. They have two on the North Dakota side, in Drayton up to the north, and then Hillsboro in the central part. The second company is Mindac Farmers Cooperative out of Wahpeton. Most of their growers are on the Minnesota side, but their factory is in North Dakota. And then the other group, the third group, is the Renville Factory, Southern Minnesota Sugar Company. and they are all Minnesota growers. I can tell you just as a footnote on economic development that if there is any expansion on any of those factories, it will be in Drayton, Hillsboro, or Wahpeton, North Dakota, and you can thank your PCA permitting process for that. They just simply won't go through the headache to do anything on Minnesota side. As I mentioned, you have to have a place to take these beets. They are worthless until they're processed. It's a high-value, high-risk, high-input crop. You have to have specialized machinery in order to harvest them. Rotation is an issue for beet growers because of root diseases. Ideally, you want 3 years, four if you can have enough land to rotate the beets on. The harvest activity runs 24 hours a day, and there's a reason for that. You want to take the beets after the first frost, but before the hard freeze. And the reason for that is the sucrose is in the leaves. And when the plant's growing, the sucrose will run down into the root and provide the sugar content. After the plant freezes, it accelerates the running of the sucrose. It doesn't kill the plant dead, but it accelerates the dropping of the sucrose. But you have to get the beets before the hard freeze at the end of October, otherwise they stay in the ground. And so long about October 1st, they'll crank up the harvest, and the growers will run 24 hours for a couple of weeks until they get them all out. And so there's a reason why that's done. So because of that, trucking is the number one issue probably for the beet growers, is the permits and the truck laws that we have. We have some ag exemptions that we need to protect for them. Again, chemical regulation is also on their minds. They use a number of products to control insects, fungus, and weeds in particular. Drainage is an issue for them. And there's also a little bit on migrant issues, not in a negative way, but just simply in terms of housing requirements. If there's legislation passed that some of the growers have houses or trailer houses during the seasonal time, also minimum wage, for example, they have to be in compliance with minimum wage. And it gets to be an issue when you do something by an acre. Sometimes the crews will bid by the hour, sometimes they'll bid by the acre. And if they bid by the acre, you still have to comply with minimum wage. And so that's an issue that we watch. I know there's bills usually every year to raise that, and so that's something they keep in track of. On the chemical regulation, probably the final point I would make is I have talked to some environmental groups just in passing in the hall, like we all do, and when they talk about regulation, I've offered to hand them a hoe and have them come out and hoe weeds, and nobody's taken me up on that yet. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's my presentation on the industry. If there's any questions on that, I sure can take them.
Why don't you proceed, please, sir?
Okay. I'll move on to potatoes. Again, concentration in the Northwest, Mr. Chairman and members. The potato growers office that I work for is out of East Grand Forks, Minnesota. The valley is a natural area for potato production, of course, because of the refrigeration that you use. Like beets, the potato crop is a high-risk, high-input, high-value crop. There's boom and bust years in the potato industry. And you don't put potatoes, of course, in a grain bin or a silo or an elevator. Most of the growers store them in warehouses that they have on their farm. That's another piece of the specialized equipment. You've got to have some natural refrigeration, and the valley is perfect for that, and that's partly why the industry grew up there. It's a direct food crop. Unlike some of the others that are processed, say, wheat into flour and soybeans into oil and so forth, the potatoes are a perishable, ready-to-eat food crop when they're taken out of the ground. Like beets, they are they're a root crop, and they're very perishable. There are some other areas of the state that I could mention, Big Lake, Glenwood. There is some potatoes around Appleton, and there is some probably in the Freeborn County, Hollandale area. So there's some other pockets. Part of the growth in those areas has to do with irrigation because the processors want a uniform product like sweet corn. They prefer potatoes and sweet corn grown under irrigation for the uniformity. There are generally, Mr. Chairman, members, there are generally four kinds of potatoes, four markets, if you will. The first is the fresh market. The fresh market is where you will get fresh reds starting in August. You can also get russets, which are baking potatoes. And the fresh market is simply the direct consumable market. There are a number of wash plants in North Dakota and Minnesota. For example, in Minnesota, you'll find one in Ada. There's a number in East Grand Forks, some of the other towns in the valley. And that's where you simply take from your warehouse, then, when you've been storing the potatoes throughout the year, you take them to a wash plant. They wash them, and they'll put them in 5, 10, 20, 50, 100-pound bags, for example, and send them off to the grocery stores. And that's the fresh market. Bruising and appearance are very big issues in the fresh market, because you can't have bruised potatoes. and for appearance. The second market to mention would be the frozen processed market. Typically, the variety there is russet Burbanks. They're the oblong, sort of brown ones with the white starchy inside. And those are used for hash browns, french fries, and so forth. McDonald's, Burger King, your outlets there use russet Burbanks. That's the frozen processed market. Anything with an Orida label on it, even though there are competitors from Idaho. I mentioned for your information that those products are the fresh or the processed and frozen products. The third class would be chipping potatoes. Potatoes grown specifically for the chip market. And this used to be a huge industry in the valley until Frito-Lay pulled out about in 92 or 93. They canceled the contracts and went with a lot of it to Texas. And a lot of the acreage left because of the chip market. The growers didn't have an outlet for their chipping potatoes. And then the last category would be seed. There are potatoes that are grown just for seed. And, of course, if you've done any gardening, you know, you cut up the eyes and you take a potato and cut it into various parts and plant that. And some of the growers in the valley plant potatoes just for seed that they sell to other growers. And the Department of Ag inspection program is important to those growers because they have to be certified by the Department of Ag. Acreage has been on the decline. In 1967 or 68, the acreage was about 33,000 in Minnesota. Last year, it was down to 10. And part of that, I mentioned, was due to the chip market, but also the irrigation. Most of that acreage has moved out to the central part of North Dakota, Jamestown, and some of those areas because they have irrigated ground there, sandy soil, so they can irrigate and let it run out, and they get a uniform potato. There's a new plant in Jamestown due to that reason. And so we've seen an acreage shift from the Minnesota side to the North Dakota side because of that. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think that would cover my notes on potatoes. The priorities are similar to beets, trucking, crop protections, research at the U, drainage, irrigation, that type of thing is also important to the potato industry. Take questions on that crop?
Representative Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clavin, just very quickly, is there any research documentation on GMO seeds being adverse to the food market?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dennis, not that I'm aware of. It's a consumer acceptance issue. The sugar beet growers are also very interested in that because they could grow a crop and kill the weeds with Roundup. We go from 6-8 different compounds to maybe one if we could do that, and we have a wider application window, clearly. But it's a granulated sweetener product, and so you've got to pay some attention to that. And so it's once again, the acceptance. It's not been proven bad.
Okay, and poultry.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to poultry. Three segments of the poultry industry for you to consider: turkeys, chickens, and eggs. Combined, those industries provide about 26,000 jobs. Starting with turkeys, Minnesota is the number one turkey production state in the country. They battled back and forth with North Carolina, but for the last couple of years, Minnesota's been number one. 46.5 million birds processed in Minnesota last year. I can tell you that Candiohi County, home of Representative Junkie over here in the corner, is the number four producing county in the country. And so a very, very big industry. I might add as a footnote, too, that all those turkeys and all those people get along pretty well in Candiohi County, I think, for the most part. And so that's a good example of living with livestock there in Candiohi County. Every turkey provides $12 in economic activity, which doesn't sound like much compared to a dairy cow, until you multiply that times 46.5 million birds, you wind up with 558 million on my calculator. There are 600 farms in Minnesota raising turkeys. The main processor, of course, is Genio. Again, it's in Wilmer and Representative Junkie's district. There's also a processing plant up in Thief River Falls called Northern Pride. They do a lot of free range. They don't have the barns, they have a free range, and of course one of the issues for them is the great horned owl scaring the flocks. I saw in the bill introductions the other day there's a great horned owl bill. I forget who has it. I don't know what it is, but we're probably going to look at that. That was an issue a couple years ago with the DNR. But nevertheless, that's the Northern Pride growers up in Thief River Falls. Turkeys consume $165 million worth of corn and soybean meal each year, so they're a major feed user here in our state. And the last figure I'd quote to you on the turkey industry is that 90% of the turkeys are exported outside of Minnesota. Obviously, with so many birds, the export market for them is a big deal. And of that 90%, 15% will go to international markets. And so the export issues are big for the turkey industry here in Minnesota. Moving on to chickens quickly, Golden Plump is the only broiler company. Chickens are often referred to as broilers when they're not laying hens. Broilers generate $99 million of economic activity here. The industry is largely in the southeast part of the state of the country. Even Golden Plump is about number 8, I think, in the country. Minnesota's production is about number 8. So most of the stuff you'll find in the chicken industry is down in the southeast. But nevertheless, they're an industry here in Minnesota, as are the layers. The layer industry, of course, is eggs. Those are chickens that are kept for eggs. Some of the companies you might know are Michael Foods. Sparbull is one. Golden Oval and Renville is another. Butterfield Foods down in the southwest. And for example, some of the usage of the eggs, you'll find cartons coming out of the Sparbull plant. You'll find some liquid eggs coming out of Golden Oval and Renville, for example, for the food service industry. To sum up for poultry, Mr. Chairman and members, some of the issues for them, feedlot rules is an ongoing issue, not so much from the water that's been under the bridge, but for anything that might be coming. The rules have been in place, and the growers pretty much know what they are, but it's always an issue that we watch. MPCA issues, both in funding, permit levels, inspections, and so forth, are on the minds of our growers there. Research at the U, once again, is an issue for them. Respiratory diseases in turkeys, avian influenza is another one. Those are important research issues, and because of that, number 4, the checkoff on the turkey side is also important because those growers participate with research dollars at the U. So once again, you see the same themes there. And with that, Mr. Chairman, those are my prepared remarks for you today.
Never at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Clayton, most of Sparbo's expansion is in Iowa now. Can you tell me why?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, Sparbo expanded in Iowa over feedlot rules and permitting, as I understand it, and the factory you could put up there. The process to get the permits in other states is maybe a week or two. For here, it's up to a year. That's why I made those comments on the beet factories in North Dakota. You won't see expansions here. It's a similar issue from what I understand.
Representative Erdahl? Thank you, Representative Panis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember the question anymore.
What's the answer?
I'll just throw the answer first. Oh, I know what it is. With any of the checkoffs, whether it be barley, wheat, or chicken checkoff, or I don't know what, do they? Yeah, I got it. Do they all go to the University of Minnesota? Are there other places that they do independent research or something with this? Check
Mr. Clavin.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tennis, there are other places that the research money can go. For example, the NDSU over in Fargo is an area where some of the beet work is done. Some of the potato work is done on that side because both states have the checkoff. So maybe more in the valley you might find that. In terms of turkey and some of that, I think it's largely at the U. There are other councils that will do research in Iowa, for example. That's the Iowa turkey growers that will do that down there. So there can be some moving out of the state of it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mull.
Mr. Chairman, quick question for Representative Junkie. Representative Junkie, did the turkeys precede you or vice versa?
No, but thank you, don't have to answer that. I love turkey. What they say, you are what you eat. Something like that. Okay. So with that, let's go quickly to Glenn Graff from the Minnesota Cattlemen. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Clayman.
You, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to committee and members. We have about 30 minutes left here. We've got 3 left to go, so it's about 10 minutes apiece with my advanced math. I also would announce that our meeting for Tuesday, February 1st, the first bill up will be the Trimble bill, and then the rest of the day will be on ethanol. And we won't be voting on ethanol that day. I think we're going to have to take some time on that one. Do it right out of committee. Okay, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Glenn Graff from Sanborn. I raise cattle, pork, corn, and soybeans down in Cottonwood County. But I'm here representing the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. MSCA represents cattle producers from all areas of the state of Minnesota. Cattlemen have always prided ourselves in not asking much from the government, but just to be left alone to do what we do best, producing the best and safest beef products in the world. The biggest issue in the beef industry at this time is bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE. This disease has received a lot of attention in the media. Just as the name implies, bovine, this is an animal health issue that needs to be addressed as that, not a human health issue. That message doesn't always make it into the reports. The state of Minnesota is in the top five in the nation with respect to the number of animals being tested for BSE. We have not found a single case in Minnesota. In fact, only one positive case has been found in the United States. That case was in Washington State on December 23rd of 2003 and traced back to its origin in Canada. In order to track animals, we need a National Animal Identification System, NAIS, that we can trace an animal back to the farm that was raised on within 24 to 48 hours. Canada has a system in place, and it is because of their ID system that they were able to track the animal back to the farm of origin. To get this system working in the U.S., we will need funding from both federal and state budgets to enable the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and the USDA to get this system up and working. MSCA supports legislation that would provide Minnesota Board of Animal Health the responsibility and the funding needed to implement the NAIS, and the data NAIS collects needs to be protected as private data of individuals. The Governor's Livestock Task Force has made recommendations for regulatory reform and economic incentives for Minnesota's livestock industry. Our industry needs to remain competitive and expand economic opportunities. MSCA strongly supports legislative and regulatory changes to keep Minnesota animal agriculture competitive. We need to maintain animal numbers here in Minnesota so that we can keep processing plants, jobs, grain, and grain byproducts used in this state, not exported to other regions of the nation and the world. Transportation is a vital element for the cattle industry in Minnesota. MSCA supports action to maintain and upgrade farm-to-market rural roads and bridges and increase weight limits for more efficient movement of our products and supplies. MSCA supports efforts to standardize truck lengths and weights across state lines. The use of triple axle trailers is good for us as well as the roads. The gray wolf is in the process of being delisted from the Endangered Species Act protection. Delisting will result in the overall management authority of the gray wolf reverting back to the state of Minnesota. With the growth in wolf numbers, the number of livestock crippled and destroyed by wolves has also been on the increase. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture has been directed to compensate livestock owners for livestock killed or crippled by a gray wolf. Recent budget cuts have eliminated the funding for these compensation programs. Therefore, MSCA supports restoration of funding to compensate livestock owners for livestock killed or crippled by gray wolves. The University of Minnesota has eliminated many beef and beef-related positions over the last several years. Cattlemen in Minnesota need our university to be a leader in beef-related research. In order for Minnesota cattle producers to remain among the most efficient in the nation, we need researchers and educators that are among the best in the nation. MSCA supports funding to reinstate those lost beef-related positions. We need those positions filled much more than we need a stadium. In closing, what is good for the beef industry in Minnesota is good for the state as a whole. Dollars invested in the beef industry turn over many times and revitalize all sectors of the state's economies. Thank you, and I'll take any questions if you had any.
Thank you, Mr. Graff. Any questions for Mr. Graff?
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. Does the Cattlemen's Association support the DNR's management plan of the gray wolf upon delisting, with the three regions, agriculture region, protected region, or would they prefer a more aggressive approach than that?
Mr. Graff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not our gray wolf expert.
Right.
I'm from the southwest corner of the state, and our members that are from the north are the ones that are having the problem with the wolf. I do know that we have asked for APHIS to continue their programs to oversee the management of the wolf, but I can try to get more information for you on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We handle them up north. I think that's where we have the problem. I'm from northwest Minnesota, and it's the SSS program, and it's shoot, shovel, and shut up.
For some Magnus, top that one.
Oh, I'm going to try to top that, Mr. Chairman, but I would ask... You're interrupting my concentration, Representative. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Graff, I have a question as far as the future of your industry, and do you anticipate this industry growing in size, and how does the growth in ethanol that we see, the governor's got a plan to double the ethanol production in the state, and how do you see that fitting in the future of the beef industry here?
Mr. Graff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, without the beef and dairy industry in Minnesota, all of the dried distillers' grains needs to be put on rail cars and exported. The more beef and dairy animals we can get in this state to use, that makes the ethanol more viable. Myself, on my farm, the only protein source that I use for my cattle are dried distillers' grains and corn and gluten from the ethanol plants.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Graff, again, I think I agree with you on that, and I think a strong ethanol industry for us to have a strong ethanol industry is key to grow industries like yours. So I would be willing to sit down and visit with you about how we grow the beef industry, especially.
Thank you, Representative Magnus. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Graff. And while Mr. Bond is coming down, I believe Representative Johnson has some guests to introduce here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like the committee to know that we've been joined by students from Gustavus Adolphus College, my alma mater, and I would like to invite two of our speakers on a regular basis, Mr. Clevin and Mr. Abbott, to raise their hands and wave at the guests. These are students from Gustavus for our January class looking at public policy issues.
Okay, and we'd like to welcome the students from St. Olaf. Or Gustavus. A bit of a slip. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Entirely forgivable.
From Gustavus, yeah. Adolphus. Very, very, very good. Mr. Bond, welcome to the Ag Committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bond. I'm Executive Director and representing the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I'll take a brief time to explain a little bit about who we are and what our interests are with your committee. I do have a position statement that I would like to distribute as well. The Trade Association has been around for about 30 years. We have about 500 members, 350 of which provide crop inputs, fertilizers, pesticides, seeds, and expert advice to the agricultural community in Minnesota. Our members are primarily in the L of Minnesota, that is the western border and the southern border, and they, by and large, our members live in and recreate in and enjoy the water and resources and the land products of the farm community, so they live where they work. We also represent and work with about 820 certified crop advisors and administer that program, which is part of the International CCA program, and they are folks who are trained to provide advice regarding crop inputs. If I could just run very briefly through this and highlight a couple of things. First of all, members, the programs, if you open up the brochure that I think was just distributed, we have member training for safety and regulatory compliance, and we do environmental award programs. Second, we provide public education information, including efforts at the high school and post-secondary level. The third point, as I mentioned, was the Certified Crop Advisor Program, which has been a very successful program here and in other states. Regarding the regulatory and legislative issues, we are have an interest in number one, there continuing the dedication of the fees to the Department of Ag. We are opposed to state sales tax on fertilizer and other crop inputs, and that, of course, has some bearing on the impaired waters legislation that you'll be hearing. Two, we are opposing local ordinances that would restrict the sale, use, storage, or transportation of crop inputs, and we would also would not like to see the repeal of state legislation that would exempt local ordinances. Three, we support crop production research. I think that's a theme you're hearing across the entire agricultural community. And we oppose the inclusion of voluntary BMPs in state or federal ag permits. We see that as simply a mandate. And then we do support crop nutrient management recommendations based on science. We see a lot of pseudoscience and inaccurate assumptions and information floating around this house. Fourth, biotech and seed issues. We oppose actions that prohibit the sale or use of crops developed through biotechnology. We oppose the mandatory labeling of foods in that regard. And we also would be supporting legislation that would prohibit local ordinances and preempt them on the state level. Fifth, we support the ACRA Fund. That is a fund that we pay into, but it does provide a very sensible way for cleanup in the event of unfortunate spills. And then we also reaffirm our support for keeping our crop protection programs in the Department of Agriculture. Six, we support, again, science-based pesticide registration process that currently goes on very nicely at the EPA and the NDA, and we see some issues cropping up that we think are misguided in that regard. In terms of the security of ag products, was mentioned earlier, we support the efforts to protect the public from illegal use. We also are concerned about unreasonable burdens and regulations on our customers and ourselves. And then finally, in terms of farm bulk storage, we think that anyone that stores pesticides and fertilizers ought to be responsible for that storage on their site when they own it or the property they have. Those are our issues. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Executive Director Bond or Senator Tremba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number four, oppose mandatory labeling of foods, etc. Why would you oppose labeling of foods?
Mr. Bond?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Trumbo, we feel that the labeling that's currently required is appropriate, and that that labeling that would be based on something other than the information that's currently provided could be misleading and has been misleading in other states.
Representative Trumbo?
Well, Mr. Chair, we label everything. We label clothing. It's required food. I think as a consumer and nutritionist and farmer that I would want, if it's good, why would you be opposed to putting it on the label?
Mr. Bond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trembley, again, we are obviously in favor of labeling. It's something that is required of the products that we use and supply to our customers, the farmers. In the essence of the time, I think we see the labeling requirement on foods as it has been used as being counterproductive to really understanding the safety of the product.
Well, Mr. Bond, aren't you talking about labeling? Basically, you're saying that we have labeling now, just leave it the way it is, and don't
Precisely.
Be bringing in where you have 87 different counties telling you how to label your product?
Precisely.
Okay.
There are local ordinances that have tried to preempt state ordinances, and that has been one of the impediments to really, in fact, consumers really understanding the products because they're so confused.
Well, Mr. Chair, as a consumer and knowing a lot of other consumers, I think that we're bright enough to know that this is a healthy food, and we require both on the federal and state level, if you have a certain percentage of some product in your food, it has to be on the label. And so I just am curious about, I was just curious about why you wouldn't want to have a totally clear label of what's in your product. And if biotechnology is good, and your industry says that it's good, and I have no way to doubt that, why wouldn't you be proud to put that on your label, is I guess my comment or question. Or
thank you, Crystal.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you much, very much, Executive Director Bond. We will now go, our final witness for the overviews we've had the last few meetings is Kay King, Executive Director, Minnesota Thoroughbred Association. And then again, members, on Monday, February 1st, we will start hearing bills. And if you have bills that you would like heard, get a hearing request in or come talk to me and we'll take a look at them. As I have mentioned before, the committee right now at this point is somewhat bill deficient. We're not getting that many bills in. And if we don't start getting some bills in, we'll hear the ones that we have on the list, and then we will probably not be meeting every committee time. So I'm trying to manage the flow of bills. It's been very easy so far. We don't have any. So I really don't want it to all bunch up right at the end. I'd like to give these bills some hearing time so that we can ask the questions and get things out on the table. So with that, Ms. King, if you could please introduce yourself and who you have at the other person you have at the table here, and we'll go from there.
I'd be happy to. My name is Kay King. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Thoroughbred Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Joining me this afternoon is Karen Offerman. Karen is an active thoroughbred owner and breeder in Minnesota and has been for many years. She's a member and past president of the Thoroughbred Association and also is on the board of directors at Canterbury Park.
And how do we spell that last name?
Offerman.
Just like you said.
It's the Karen that's tricky. It's Carin.
Oh, we weren't even close. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The Minnesota Thoroughbred Association exists to provide Minnesota horse owners and breeders with quality opportunities to breed, buy, sell, and race competitive Minnesota bred horses. Today I'm here to tell you a few things about the Minnesota horse industry. Our equine industry is often overlooked in the state's discussion of animal agriculture because the end product isn't food, it's recreation, competition, and therapy. Minnesota is home to 87 4-H horse clubs, over 200 Western saddle clubs, and clubs for each of the major breeds, including the Quarter Horse Association, with over 5,000 registered owners in the state. Minnesota also has numerous therapeutic riding centers and activity horse events from hunter jumpers to trail rides. The impact of the horse industry is felt in a very real way all across the state. Equine agriculture impacts Main Street Minnesota on a daily basis. Last winter, the University of Minnesota released an analysis of the impact of horses on Minnesota's economy. You have a copy of that study as well as a summary in your packets today. The key conclusions of their work were, horses are a critical part of Minnesota's agricultural industry. Horses are responsible for generating nearly $1 billion of economic activity in Minnesota each year, generating $930 million in direct and indirect economic benefits. Minnesota's 155,000 horses produce work for horse breeders, trainers, veterinarians, and farmers. On the average, each horse produces $6,002 of total economic impact, placing horses among the highest valued agricultural animals. And finally, horses are bred and raised in all of Minnesota's 87 rural and metro counties. Since the study, new 2002 Census of Agriculture information has become available. Mr. Chair, you may be interested to know that Fillmore County ranks fourth in Minnesota with 2,777 horses on 377 individual farms. The county with the greatest number of horses is Stearns County with over 3,300 horses. Other committee members will find their districts, which are also listed on your green sheet, and all areas are greatly affected by those of us in the horse industry. But while Minnesota ranks high nationally in the number of horses, we have substantial room for growth in the economic value and impact of the industry. In fact, although we are ninth in total number of horses nationwide, we rank just 45th in the total value of horses. The analysis found the best way to increase the value of the horse industry in the state is to increase the purses for racing and invest in show horse infrastructure, as these horses have a greater economic value and impact than pleasure horses. Investments in these areas will generate increased spending on the horses in forms of feed, training, tack, equipment, veterinary care, and in other areas. The net result is an increase in the value of horse stock. While I'm not here to talk about parimutuel wagering or any other form of gaming, I do want to point out how vital the continued investment in our racetrack, as well as the addition of a major horse show venue, would be to the development of the horse industry. There is a proposal with a lot of horsepower floating around out there that would do both. Again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come here today and discuss the horse industry in the context of Minnesota's animal agriculture economy. Horses are a major economic driver in the state and a strong component of our overall agricultural economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In Fillmore County, do you include the Amish horses, or would this just be the horse farms that are non-Amish?
It's based on the census data in 1997. So, and the green sheet compares the 1997 data to the most current, which is 2002. So there has been an increase since then.
Okay, interesting. Thank you. Any questions for members? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tonight, and ladies, I see in the green sheet that there's quite an increase in both the number of farms and the number of horses from 97 to 02. Is that a trend that's continuing? Is this a trend you see continuing since then till now? And where do you see this going?
Executive Director King?
We are seeing the growth in a lot of hobby farms or smaller farms where people have one or two or three horses as the metro is spreading further and further out. I live in Le Sueur, and we have small horses, you know, horse farms all around. 4 years ago, we didn't have any horses on our farm. We now have six and are patiently awaiting the arrival of number seven.
Mr. Magnus?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Anything else? I'm glad we didn't overlook you. You said you're the most overlooked. We got you in.
You saved the best for last. Thank you.
That's right. Yes, we did. Okay, with that, next meeting, February 1st, the Otremba Bell, the Davids Bell, good government all the time. We are